everybody, and welcome to another episode of Max Planck Florida's Neurotransmissions Podcast. I'm Michael Yedman, and I'm joined today by my co-host and lab mate, Andre Steinicke. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm also fine. So today we have a very special episode in which we talk about how the brain becomes what it is, how it grows up. So how do we get this incredibly complicated organ from a single cell during the process of development?
Yes, and I think that's an awesome project as we both work on it for our last couple of years. And we are joined by our guest, Professor Oscar Marin. He's the head of the Department of Developmental Biology, Neurobiology in King's College in London, UK. And he's also the director of MRC Center for Neurodevelopmental Disorders in King's College, London. Welcome, Dr. Marin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yes. So as Mike already mentioned, we're making a show about developmental neurobiology, right? And essentially this very diverse very complex organ, the most complex organ in our organism, is pretty much deriving from one cell. But, you know, nowadays, a lot of people are caring about connectivity and what sub-circuits, sub-networks of the brain actually do amongst certain behaviors. But you study the brain from a little bit of a different perspective, from the developmental perspective, right? So what can we actually learn from studying developmental neurobiology?
I think looking at the brain, you have these two approaches of how you could do this. And perhaps the more trendy one these days is to look at an approach in which you will map reality. You will map the entire brain down to the ultimate connections. So you essentially want to recreate a one-to-one map of reality and then infer how it works from that principle. The advantage of that approach is that you have all the information.
Yeah.
My take on it is that you probably have too much information, but our approach is kind of the opposite to that. The idea is to use more of an engineer kind of point of view. This idea of, you know, if you learn how you build a system, you may actually infer how it may actually work. Now, there's a gap also there, right? So you may learn how it's built and yet not learn anything about how it works. But our feeling is that by understanding what are the fundamental principles in which this very complex system is put together, you could actually identify, sign up the functions that eventually is going to perform. So I think these two approaches, bottom-up, top-down, looking at from the adult perspective or looking at how it's built, both are complementary, essentially.
Yes, so you pretty much follow from a reductionist perspective onto how you build this very complex environment and complex organ. That's very fascinating.
Yeah, so speaking of complexity, you've spent a lot of your career studying the development of the cerebral cortex. And one of the founders of modern neuroscience, Ramoni Cajal, described the cerebral cortex and the circuits therein as being an impenetrable jungle. So I was wondering if you could speak to how a modern developmental neurobiologist sort of unweaves this impenetrable jungle.
It's interesting that you mention Cajal after spending a lot of time looking at the adult brain. After a while, he decided to look at developmental structures because he thought it was going to be easier to capture things out of there. I think that the progress we had made on tools to dissect different populations of cells in the brain, essentially going back to the principle that Cajal established very early on, identifying different cell types and now having a handle on how to label them, how to manipulate them, and follow them over time. I think that it has given us a lot of insight into how things are put together. I think for function, it's going to be essentially the same. I think we are just walking our way into being able to distinguish individual populations of cells in the brain and then now realizing that they all do, you know, similar but slightly different things. And I think that most of our progress over the last 20, 30 years have been recognizing that even though the whole choreography seems to be happening at the same time and they seem to be all doing more or less the same, every population of neurons, every population of cells in the brain and its build are doing slightly different things. And we need to tear them apart to be able to understand what's happening. So I think that the tools in that sense, so the genetic tools over the last 20 years or so has actually allowed us to get here.
That's great. So you're speaking about different types of neurons, and that's in fact what makes the brain so diverse, right? So it's cell type diversity and connectivity diversity, right? So, and you're focusing in your research on a particular type of neurons. It's the inhibitory interneurons that are pretty much making up 20% of the neuronal population in the brain. And they have a specific type of development, and they make up already also a very large proportion of cell diversity. Can you speak to that a little bit, and so how they actually develop?
Yeah, I mean, it historically is a fascinating problem, because when you look at the last 20 years or 30 years of neuroscience and developmental neuroscience, perhaps understanding how the cortex is built is the one place in which we have made so much more transformative changes. And, you know, before the beginning of the new century, we thought that both populations of neurons in the cortex, excitatory pyramidal cells and inhibitory cells, were essentially coming from the same place and then just mixing up to make these very complex circuits in the cortex. But it was around the year 2097, and specifically, that we found, this was found actually in John Rubinstein's lab back in UCSF, that these two pool of progenitor cells, the origin of these two main populations of neurons in the cortex, are actually in different places in the embryo. And essentially, they produce these different populations of cells that then eventually, through migration, by displacement in the embryo, come to the same place in the cortex to make these circuits. And this is something that we have only learned 20 years ago, which seems like, you know, forever in time, but it's relatively recent compared to many other things. And this has been quite transformative, because it has many different implications for understanding how the cortex functions, and both in health and in disease. Essentially, we now know that these cells are made in very different ways, and you could have genetic defects affecting only one population of cells, excitatory cells, for example, without touching inhibitory cells, or the reverse. You will have some mutations that will only affect inhibitory cells and not excitatory cells. So something quite fundamental, which is just understanding how these cells come about during development, has opened an entire field of understanding how these two things come together and what are the implications of their development.
One of the interesting things that you mentioned in your talk that kind of speaks to that is the fact that if you look at different species or throughout different brain regions, you seem to maintain this ratio of about 4-to-1 between the excitatory sort of go neurons and the inhibitory stop neurons. So recently there's been a lot of work showing that many human conditions and mouse models of neurological and psychiatric diseases have imbalances in this ratio of the excitation, the go, and the stop. So I was wondering how you think that research into these fundamental properties of how these circuits develop in the right ratios can inform disease research.
I think it has relatively profound implications. I think this is such a fundamental rule in the way we build cortices, and, you know, human build their cortices, but all other species build the cortices. I think it's going to have, you know, it's going to have very important implications. It's a relatively simple concept. You cannot build the cortical structure only with go cells, with excitatory cells. If you only have excitatory cells, you essentially have runaway excitation, and you essentially have epilepsy. So if you only build you know, computational machines with excitatory cells, you basically end up probably dying. So in evolution, what we have done in the system, you know, evolution has recruited inhibitory cells to complement these circuits. And what is fascinating is that you really need to seem to have a constant balance that is about this 4-to-1 proportion. And independently of different regions of the cortex, different species, we seem to see that this is relatively stable, suggesting that this is, you know, it's a fundamental principle having achieving this balance between these two populations. So setting up the right numbers is perhaps very important, because one would expect that even though you can have compensatory mechanisms afterwards, that, you know, if you are too off from this proportion, that might lead to important problems. And you're completely right. I mean, I think that we have more and more evidence supporting, this generally iffy term of EI balance, excitatory inhibitory balance, being very important in psychiatric disorders. And you can think about this as a problem, a spectrum of disorders in which, this balance between excitation and inhibition is perturbed in different ways. In some cases, in very extreme ways, leading to epilepsy, and in other cases, in more subtle ways, perhaps affecting computations in the cortex in a much more subtle way, and maybe affecting cognition and social behavior in different ways.
I was wondering if you learned something about development, right? So you're building up circuits. Could you also learn something about neurodegenerative diseases? So when you actually lose connections, something, speaking of Alzheimer's disease and things like this. So does studying the development actually lead to any insights into these neurodegenerative diseases?
Yeah. I mean, one extreme view of brain development is that it never ends. And so this is, I think, conceptually quite interesting. Every time that I start talking about brain development, almost immediately anybody that I talk to are thinking about the embryo. They're thinking about prenatal development. And I always come back to them by saying, in humans, even if you consider brain development a limited stage of your life, it will take 20 years. So it's not something that happens just in the embryo. It's something that is evolving for many, many years. And in humans, we know that we're still pruning, we're still modifying our connections very late in your teen years, and you're still forming new connections and making more robust. And essentially, every time that we learn, we reuse the same mechanisms that we use in development, and we call them plasticity, but essentially, we also modify our connections to be able to learn and to forget things. So this is a long way to come to the point and say that I do think that development will also probably inform neurodegeneration, and there's a good number of evidences already suggesting that many of the problems that we see relatively late in life may actually emerge much earlier. And the main difference might be that our brain is very resilient, and it might find ways to cope with many of these problems for many, many years before they actually become very, very dramatic. And in any case, some of the first early perturbations that we see following the generation, for example, in Alzheimer's, are also linked to some of the same problems we were discussing before for neurodevelopmental disorders. So, imbalances between excitation and inhibition, and essentially leading to early cognitive deficits, perhaps because of the same reason. So I think one thing that is important in neuroscience is try to avoid silos and try to avoid people getting too comfortable in their own mix. I work in neurodevelopmental disorders, you work in neurodegeneration, and understanding brain function as very continuous process in which again and again the same kind of basic principles are recycled.
One of the sort of interesting parallels to Andre's question about neurodegeneration and how it plays into development is a really interesting thing that you mentioned in your seminar today, which is that there's this role that not neurodegeneration or toxic cell death, but controlled cell death plays during development.
Yeah, the very fascinating things that we have been studying lately is a textbook kind of idea of developmental cell death. And I think this is something we know for many years now that during brain development, you make also in the peripheral nervous system, you make many more neurons that you eventually need. And it's always been slightly unclear why you do this. And there are many, ideas or hypotheses around that. One of the main idea being that you make more to make sure that only the ones, the neurons that end up connected properly are rescued or survive. And in the case of the cortex, it's quite fascinating because this process, at least for inhibitory neurons, is massive. You actually overproduce 40% of your interneurons. So it's a quite a massive number of cells that you spend energy in the embryo to create. And we think it's essentially necessary to build a cortex that is eventually balanced by pairing them with their excitatory cell types in forming specific circuits. But at the same time, it might have been the only way in which we have been able to evolve with this very weird kind of system of making the two main classes of neurons in the cortex in completely different places. I mean, there are plenty of examples in the brain and in spinal cord in which you can make two very different cell types next to one another. So there's no immediate need for you to generate these two cells at a distance. And yet we have, in evolution, get stuck with this way of building a cortex, a very important structure for brain functioning by generating these cells at a distance. It probably brought some kind of advantage at some point in evolution. So I think that having this system to overproduce cell numbers and eventually trim them down to the right ones has also allowed us the ability to grow a much larger cortex with much larger population of excitatory cells, because we have all this excessive number of interneurons we can play with early in postnatal development to adjust for the growth of excitatory cells. So I think this is a very good example of how probably serendipity during evolution and creating a relatively simple but very robust system that allow for a lot of variation, individual variation and interspecies variation, and allow you to cope with a lot of change without ending up with, for example, too many excitatory versus inhibitory cells, and which will be lethal essentially.
That's super interesting to me. So you also mentioned in your talk that you can also manipulate the apoptosis in the mouse system. So a little thought experiment, if you can stop the apoptosis of these many neurons, will I become more intelligent, or what does actually the amount of cells in the brain mean?
The short answer is that we don't know yet. Experiments that we're still doing, but I think that the one first thing is that you need to have a balance between these two. I think this is the first fundamental thing. You need to end up with the right proportion between these two cell types. Because even though, plasticity mechanisms go beyond the cell type, and you can have synaptic plasticity, so you can have more refined plasticity mechanisms controlling the number of connections that, for example, each of these cells make. And you can have more or less cells, but then eventually play with the number of connections to, again, allow some balance. I think for the numbers, you need to come up with the right ballpark of cells. So I think once you have an imbalance, you are going to end up having a problem. And for example, there is some evidence in previous studies suggesting that perhaps in disorders like autism, maybe part of the problem is that you end up having too much inhibition in specific regions of the cortex. So we're very tempted to explore this in our animal models, in which we can create animals with more excitatory and more inhibitory, or normal excitatory and more inhibitory. The reverse, we know what happens. When you have too few inhibitory interneurons, then you do have epilepsy. That's very clear. But we don't know much of what happens the other way around when you have a bit too much inhibition. And I think this is a good way of actually testing this this idea.
So this is a sort of random question, but speaking of disease and development, are there any examples of disease conditions or mutations in particular genes that affect the controlled cell death or apoptotic pathways, that sort of like natural experiments in creating too many cells in the brain?
Yeah, so I didn't talk about this as part of my talk because we didn't have time to go into those details, but we have worked a little bit around the molecular mechanisms controlling cell death. And actually, it just came from talking to Jason across the street at the Scrip, and we actually, I just realized that we have ended up on the same kind of mechanism by randomness, which is quite interesting. How this, you can do the same experiments on an ocean apart. And one of the elements that we think is essential for controlling cell death of inhibitory cells in the cortex is a protein called P10 that Jason actually studies has been studying for quite a long time, and this is a protein that is important in many contexts and in many other contexts like cancer, for example, has been known to be very important for regulating apoptosis, cell death. And what we have found is that in interneurons, this protein also plays a very important role in cell death. Essentially, you know, de facto interneurons actually commit suicide. So they are programmed to commit suicide unless somebody saves them from that fate. And that's what excitatory cells do. And part of the mechanism that we think is driving cell death is this: is an elevation of P10 during early development. So this protein gets elevated, and it drives basically mechanisms that make the cell to die. So mutants for P10, you can do that in mice. You can remove this protein genetically. If you do that, then interneurons don't die. No matter what you do, they don't normally die. And this is quite interesting because mutations in P10 has been linked to macrocephaly and a particular form of autism in kids. It actually accounts for a large proportion of autistic kids that have also macrocephaly, macrocephaly meaning having too many neurons in the brain. So we think it's quite interesting that we have also seen that when you don't have this protein in mice, part of what's happening is that you end up with way too many interneurons, perhaps way too much inhibition in the brain. So we're very interested in trying to follow this this up. And one of the things that we're trying to do now is try to understand whether humans use essentially the same mechanism to control cell numbers in the cortex. And that's part of what we're trying to investigate now.
Very interesting. And I also find it very interesting that there's this big controversy right now in the field whether humans have adult neurogenesis or not. Adult neurogenesis meaning that you still have dividing cells in your adult brain that then integrate into the circuit and do what? So does it actually make any sense to have this, or what do you think about the big controversy about this?
I mean, it's a fascinating story because the field has, you know, the field of adult neurogenesis over the last 20 years or so has made so much progress in understanding how these new neurons are wired into a relatively stable circuit at that point. And, which, you know, essentially what we have learned is that they use the same mechanisms that other neurons use in development to accommodate themselves into circuits. And I think the idea that the new neurons coming into a circuit will enhance plasticity, I think, is quite appealing. And having them, particularly in the rodent brain, at least in two places, the olfactory bulb and in the hippocampus, where, you know, plasticity is relatively important for the function of these regions, I think is quite interesting. I don't know. I think it's still up in the air. First controversial study published by Arturo Alvarez is the one that tends to suggest that maybe neurogenesis is less relevant in humans than we thought before. I don't know. I find it quite convincing, and I know Arturo is a fairly thorough kind of scientist. But then again, the other study also looks quite thorough in cells. So I guess it's you know, something we will need to follow. I think that's the way science progress in general. I mean, essentially, I think the important thing is to get the facts right, and then the interpretations may actually adapt to, you know, when new data become available. What's really relevant is to make sure that our data is collected in the right way. But it's a fascinating fascinating thing with implications at all levels, you know, especially for the pharmaceutical industry.
Another possibility to get new neurons into the cortex is to transplant, for example, induce pluripotent stem cells into the adult brain, right? But now you also showed today that there might be some problems with this, or with embryonic stem cells, right? So you showed very nicely that you don't end up getting a certain subpopulation of neurons, no matter what you try and what you do. So in that sense, more research is necessary in that field to actually also learn more how far can we go with transplantation approaches?
You know, I think cell therapy in general, mm-hmm. the idea of cell therapy in the brain, I think is still fascinating. I think it's something that has a long way to go. I think that we need to understand several things. One is how to make precise populations of neurons, and we go back to the idea of diversity at the beginning, and it's really relevant, you know, not all cells are made equal and not all neurons are made equal. So it's really relevant to understand precisely how you make the right cell. And the other thing is that you may need to accept that you are not going to be able to reproduce the same cell type in the same circumstances by just transplanting that into the other brain. And I think this is probably fine. We can maybe accept that, you know, it's 80% right and 20% off. And you know, one of the ways of using these cells is not so much about maybe rebuilding the circuit in exactly the right, you know, manner, but maybe just using them as either vehicles or as a way to provide, for example, with additional inhibition. Or, you know, there's many people working on this, for example, in the context of untreatable epilepsy. And in, you know, from that therapeutical context, I think it's very, very important to know all the neuroscience facts. It's important to know all the fundamental neuroscience. But at the end of the day, when you are treating a patient, when you're thinking about developing a therapy, what is really important is that it works, and not so much that it does it in exactly the same way that it's built in normal brain development. So I think it's fundamental neuroscience needs to inform these approaches and know the limitations, and then it's okay to move away from them if that still gives us a handle into dealing with an important problem.
Thank you so much, Dr. Marine, for joining us and telling us why we should care about development.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So that's our show for today, and thank you to Professor Oscar Marine for telling us something about neurodevelopment.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear how learning about the fundamental way in which the brain develops and how this can inform our sort of understanding of disease and evolution and all these different aspects of biology.
It was so interesting to learn that you lose neurons, and that's an absolutely natural and normal process. I think that just occurs while drinking alcohol.
At least with me. Thank you to our producers in the Office of Scientific Communications and our sound engineer, Joe Schumacher, for recording this episode. Follow us on Twitter at Neuropodcast, and please feel free to subscribe to us or like us wherever you can. Goodbye.
Bye. What's up? Engineer Joe in the house.